instructions about what McCammon calls White House business. Morsund, questioned by journalists the next year, would insist that his job as the principal trustee of Johnson's blind trust was to see to it that Johnsons don't know what is going on, and he would insist that is what he did. It's not at all tough for me to do what I'm supposed to do. Evidently, however, his job was tougher than he admitted. With Morsund, he would talk about business, not White House business, McCammon says. A.W. was a trustee, so there was a whole lot of discussion on different money matters. The two secretaries were not expected to deal with personal business matters. Mr. Johnson and Judge Morsund would talk privately, looking at things, those, Famer says. She became so accustomed to such discussions that after a while, I didn't even take notice of it. The president was also making arrangements so that the discussions could continue after his return to Washington. A new telephone was placed on a counter in the kitchen of Morsund's home. It was linked by a private telephone circuit to the LBJ Ranch and the White House, so that the judge can pick up his phone and talk almost instantaneously with the president, the Wall Street Journal was to report. Although, Morsund insisted, in what the Journal described as a heated reply to its inquiries, that the Johnsons nonetheless don't know what is going on in their business. Morsund was not the only business associate with whom Johnson took drives around his ranch. Jesse Kellum sometimes accompanied him, and with KTBC's general manager, the same thing, McCammon says. And Johnson was to talk regularly with Kellum, too, after he was back in the White House, although in Kellum's case the arrangements would be more complicated. Sometimes when Kellum was having dinner with friends in Austin, the beeper he wore on his belt would buzz. He would excuse himself, saying he had to make a phone call, but he wouldn't make it from a pay telephone in the restaurant. He would return to his office and make it from there. Ed Clark understood why. The beeper was summoning Kellum to talk to the president, and the talk was to be conducted in privacy. Another locale being linked that Christmas to the White House was the Johnson City office of the law firm of Morsund and Ferguson. The telephones on the desks of the two partners were replaced by new ones, with an added button. It wasn't labeled or anything, but when you pushed that, you got the White House's board in Washington, says Morsund's partner, Thomas C. Ferguson, an influential Hill Country politician, former district judge, and chairman of the Texas State Board of Insurance. And while Morsund would maintain over and over during the entire Johnson presidency that no business was discussed over those office lines, that is not what Ferguson says. When the author asked him whether Johnson conducted personal business over those lines, Ferguson replied, "Oh, yeah, he and Morsund were talking every day. You see, Morsund was trustee of all his property, one of these blind trusts. It wasn't very blind." The author asked Ferguson if he himself had conducted business for Johnson during his presidency. "Myself? Oh, yes," Ferguson replied, and provided the details of several such transactions. Johnson's business dealings during his presidency will be discussed in the next volume of this work. Other lines were installed, in the law firm of Clark, Thomas, Harris, Denius, and Winters in Austin, one on Ed Clark's desk, one on Donald Thomas's, in Earl Deeth's office down the hall from Kellum's at KTBC. Another was placed in Deeth's home. By the conclusion of the Christmas trip, the phones were all in. Calls were not restricted to office hours. Johnson wanted to be able to make calls to these men not only from the Oval Office, but from his living quarters in the White House. And he didn't want those calls to go through the White House switchboard. "I want an outside phone line installed in my bedroom, like that other one where I don't have to go through any operator," he told Walter Jenkins not long after his return from Texas. "Can I do that? I'd like to make a private call. When I talk to A.W. Morsund, when I talk to any of them, I don't like the..." He could do that. Whatever it was he didn't like, perhaps the fact that a log is kept of all calls to and from a president that go through the White House switchboard, perhaps the chance that an operator might listen in on the call, the recording becomes too garbled at this point to understand his next words, was promptly changed. The outside line was installed, and after it was, Marie Famer says, "We could not know the calls he had placed from the bedroom. White House phone logs and operators would have no record of them." There would be a lot of such calls. Every night he told Morsund what to do, Ferguson told the author. A lot of it was Johnson saying to Morsund, "Well, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to get this piece of land, I want to stock, with cattle, certain places." And of course, at that time, anything Morson said stood up through the Johnson properties, and he would carry out what the president would tell him he wanted done. It was a very unblind trust as far as that trust was concerned. Morson would arrive at the law firm office the next morning, with instructions that Johnson had given him in calls to his home the previous evening. Often he would tell Ferguson Johnson had been lying in bed in the White House when he called. Earl Deeth also speaks of late night and some early morning calls from the White House. "Sometimes he'd call you 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning," he says. After these lines were installed, Clark says Johnson wanted his dealings about his business interests conducted over these direct phone lines. All during Lyndon Johnson's presidency, he, either himself or through a press secretary, would insist that he had divorced himself completely from his business interests. "As the American people know," George Reedy said in one of many such statements, all approved word for word by the president has devoted all his time and energy to the public business, and he is not engaged in any private enterprise, directly or indirectly. And all during his presidency, the phones stayed in place, and the calls went on. There was deception and secrecy during that Christmas trip in not only personal affairs, but governmental. If Vietnam initially seemed to him to be a part of the breathing space he had been provided on foreign affairs, the only immediate decisions necessary, the ones he had made in his NSAM 273 of November 26th, he had been quickly disabused of that impression. Within days he was reading new reports that the military situation, particularly in Vietnam's Mekong Delta, was deteriorating, and that the new junta was disorganized. One report from Lodge said that in a key province, the past 30 days have produced a day-by-day increase in Viet Cong influence, military operations, physical control of the countryside. The earlier reports, Johnson would say in his memoirs, using phrases that to him were particularly damning, were wishful thinking. "We had been misled into over-optimism." He dispatched McNamara, along with McCone and Assistant Secretary of Defense William P. Bundy, McGeorge's brother, to Vietnam, giving McNamara quite a lecture, expressing concern that we as a government were not doing everything we should, and the Defense Secretary's report, delivered on his return to Washington on December 21st, said that the situation is very disturbing. Current trends, unless reversed in the next 2 to 3 months, will lead to neutralization at best, and most likely to a communist-controlled state. We should watch the situation very carefully, running scared, hoping for the best, but preparing for more forceful moves if the situation does not show early signs of improvement. McCone, in a brief report of his own, said he felt a little less pessimistic than McNamara, but to Johnson the time for less pessimism, for wishful thinking in any form, was over. His views had been hardening, or perhaps only becoming more apparent. Strong as were the militant voices in Congress, there were voices on the other side, too, but the new president wasn't listening to them. Ill-equipped though Mike Mansfield was to be majority leader, he was well qualified indeed to give advice on Vietnam, having been not only a professor of East Asian history, but one with a thoughtful overview of that part of the world. And on December 7th, he had given Johnson a memo saying continuation of the war there would be costly to America, and urging less reliance on a military solution in Vietnam and more on a political. Johnson's response in a conversation with Mansfield's aide Francis R. Vallejo, Secretary of the Senate, on the evening of December 23rd, the day before he left for Texas, was to ask for another memo from Mansfield, and he made the request in words that made clear the advice he wanted. "What are we going to do about Vietnam?" he said. "We're going to lose that war. Do you want that to be another China? Get me a memo on it. I don't want these people around the world worrying about us, and they are. They're worried about whether you've got a weak president or a strong president." And when Mansfield didn't take the hint, saying in his second memo, As you remarked to Vallejo on the telephone, we do not want another China in Vietnam, but neither do we want another Korea. A key factor in both situations was a tendency to bite off more than we were prepared in the end to chew. We are close to the point of no return in Vietnam. Johnson's response would be to solicit memoranda from McNamara, Rusk, and Bundy to counter Mansfield's arguments. The stakes in preserving an anti-communist South Vietnam are so high that in our judgment we must go on bending every effort to win, McNamara's said. Rusk arrived at the ranch with a memo that he handed to Johnson in which he wrote that there was need for a presidential statement emphasizing the urgency of action to reverse the adverse trend in the war as well as reaffirming the United States policy of complete support for the Vietnamese government. And included in the president's response to McNamara's disturbing report was approval of two of its recommendations, that more United States advisors be sent from Saigon to the Mekong Delta and other embattled provinces, and that an interdepartmental committee chaired by Marine Lieutenant General Victor H. Brute Krulak be created to study Op Plan 34A, the proposal for covert military operations against North Vietnam, and to designate those operations with the least risk and the most plausibility of denial. The Krulak Committee's report, which called for progressively escalating pressure to inflict increasing punishment upon North Vietnam, arrived at the Johnson Ranch on January 2nd. Among the operations it recommended, all to be carried out during the next 12 months, were guerrilla raids against the Ho Chi Minh Trail, hit-and-run commando raids along the North Vietnamese coasts, and shelling by American warships of North Vietnamese military installations on the coast of the Gulf of Tonkin. "There's one of three things you can do about Vietnam," the president would soon be saying in a telephone call from the ranch to John Knight of Knight Ridder Newspapers, a supporter who nonetheless felt the United States might be overcommitted in Vietnam. "One is run and let the dominoes start falling over. God almighty, what they said about us leaving China would just be warming up compared to what they'd say now. You can run or you can fight, as we are doing, or you can sit down and agree to neutralize all of it. But nobody is going to neutralize North Vietnam, so that's totally impractical. And so it really boils down to one of two decisions, getting out or getting in. But we can't abandon it to them, as I see it." The great questions about the Vietnam War, including the questions of whether Lyndon Johnson had feasible choices other than the ones he spelled out in that telephone call, of whether it is true, as one of his biographers says, that no president, especially an unproven, unelected one, could simply have withdrawn without some real hope that the South Vietnamese could have held off a Viet Cong North Vietnamese takeover, of whether, if other feasible options existed, Johnson pursued them with sincerity, and of whether, had John F. Kennedy lived, United States policy would have been different from the policy Johnson pursued. These questions are among those that must remain to be examined in the next volume of this work. However, two aspects of the early decisions on Vietnam, early steps on what was to be a very long road that Johnson took during that Christmas vacation on the ranch, are clear. First, whatever steps he took during that vacation, he took as well steps to conceal them, to keep them secret from Congress and the American people. And second, the steps he took had, as their unifying principle, an objective dictated largely by domestic, indeed personal, political concerns. By the time McNamara had completed his trip to Vietnam, it was clear that the plan for withdrawing U.S. forces was no longer workable, says William C. Gibbons, author of a definitive study of Vietnam policymaking, but no announcement was made that the plan, the first stage of which was the withdrawal of 1,000 troops by the end of the year, was not being carried out. Instead, there was, in Gibbons's phrase, juggling the figures. Every month, more than 1,000 soldiers routinely left Vietnam as part of regular troop rotations to be replaced by an equal number of new soldiers. During the first part of December, the rotation schedule had been on a pace to achieve the 1,000-man reduction, but following McNamara's trip, while the rotation out of Vietnam was continued, the replacement pipeline was slowed somewhat. The departure of the troops originally scheduled to be sent to Vietnam in the last weeks of December was delayed. They were simply sent in January and February instead. In the last weeks of 1963, plans for phased withdrawal of 1,000 advisors by end-year 1963 went through the motions by concentrating rotations home in December and letting strength rebound in the subsequent 2 months, the Pentagon Papers explained. At the end of the year, the number of United States military personnel in Vietnam was 15,914, a number which, as the Pentagon Papers noted, did not even represent a decline of 1,000 from the peak of 16,732, being in fact only 818 lower. Even the 818 figure was illusory. As soon as the year ended, the replacement pipeline was speeded up, and within a matter of weeks, troop strength was back at its peak level, so that there was in fact no reduction at all. December's planned 1,000-man reduction therefore proved essentially an accounting exercise, the Pentagon Papers explained. But Johnson was to announce that the plan had been carried out. "We have called back approximately 1,000 people," he said in a press conference on March 7, 1964. In another development, the more forceful moves for which McNamara had said the administration should be preparing were indeed being prepared. The Krulak Committee's report, which had arrived at the ranch on January 2nd, would not be formally approved by the president until January 16th, but the covert operations it authorized, including the ones around the Gulf of Tonkin, were to begin on February 1st. The approval of the plan, in effect an escalation of the war, although a minor one, was never announced to the public or revealed to Congress, although a few members may have been quietly advised of some of the details. A national security action memorandum would have normally been signed by the president as a result of the approval. No such memorandum was ever signed. The overriding aim of the withdrawal and covert operations decisions, and of other decisions about Vietnam during the early days of Lyndon Johnson's presidency, was to keep Vietnam from becoming a major political issue, above all else, as Frederick Logoval put it in Choosing War, a detailed study of American decision-making from 1963 through 1965, to keep Vietnam from complicating his election year strategy. The president judged all options on the war in terms of what they meant for November. So close to his vest was Johnson holding his cards on Vietnam that even McGeorge Bundy, who was carrying out his strategy, wasn't sure what it was. When, on March 2, 1964, the National Security Advisor was driven to ask him, "What is your own internal thinking on this, the overall Vietnam situation, Mr. President?" Johnson gave him his clearest answer yet. "I just can't believe that we can't take 15,000 advisors and 200,000 people, South Vietnamese troops, and maintain the status quo for 6 months. I just believe we can do that if we do it right." 6 months might have been a minor miscalculation. Election Day 1964, November 3rd, was not 6 months away but 8. But it might not have been. The Democratic National Convention would begin on August 24th, in slightly less than 6 months. Sitting president though he was, there was Bobby Kennedy to consider. Miscalculation or not, however, the president's aim was clear: the maintenance of the status quo until a date set by a political calendar. Ruthlessness, secretiveness, deceit, significant elements in every previous stage of Lyndon Johnson's life story. Not always, however, the only elements, not always the only character traits, contradictory though other traits might be. And sometimes these other elements, the anger at injustice, the sympathy, empathy, identification with the underdog that added up to compassion, had been expressed by this master of the political gesture in gestures so deeply meaningful, so perfect in their symbolism, that they reached a level for which mastery is an inadequate term. "By God, we'll bury him in Arlington," he had blurted in the very instant he was told that a Mexican-American war hero had been denied burial in a whites-only cemetery in South Texas. See Master of the Senate, pages 740 and following. This stage of the story, Christmas vacation at the ranch, was no different. If most of the gestures Lyndon Johnson made during those 2 weeks in Texas were mainly for effect, stage business to reinforce the personal image he wanted to project. One gesture was something more. Friends of Horace Busby were giving him a birthday party that New Year's Eve in Austin's 40 Acres Club, which was, like most of the city's clubs, rigidly segregated. Although many University of Texas faculty members had resigned from the club in protest the previous year after a black Peace Corps official had been told he couldn't have a drink there, the rule against any African-American being given a room, a meal, or a drink was still firmly in place. On New Year's Eve, however, Johnson went party hopping in Austin. Lady Bird, exhausted, said she was staying home, so Johnson took his secretaries along on the helicopter ride to Austin, and then in his limousine, and one of the parties he went to was Busby's. And just before he entered the 40 Acres Club, he took Jerry Whittington's arm and put it through his. The guests at Busby's party were standing around having cocktails and talking. All of a sudden, the Secret Service appeared, recalls a law professor, E. Ernest Goldstein. And a few minutes later, in walked President Johnson with Jerry Whittington on his arm, and she was beautiful and black. No one told Johnson he and his companion couldn't come in. No one, in fact, made any fuss at all. To Moyers, trailing behind the couple, the striking fact about the guest's reaction was that there was none. No gasp. Nothing was made of it. Everyone studiously went on with their conversations. "Does the president know what he's doing?" Goldstein asked Moyers. "He always knows what he's doing," Moyers replied. The president stayed for about an hour, Jerry Whittington on his arm, chatting with the Busbys and their friends, and during that hour no one mentioned civil rights or desegregation. Among the items of conversation was banter about how many supermarket trading stamps the White House must be accumulating because of all the groceries it had to order for dinner parties. But the next day, the day following what Goldstein calls that magnificent evening, the professor telephoned the club to ask if he could bring black guests that afternoon. The answer was laconic, he would recall. "Okay, no problem," I insisted. "Is the club really integrated?" The reply this time was loud and clear. "Yes, sir, the President of the United States integrated us on New Year's Eve." And sometimes, as in previous stages of Lyndon Johnson's life when compassion and ambition had coincided, during that Christmas in Texas, the compassion was expressed in a manner that went beyond a gesture. During that Christmas, in fact, Lyndon Johnson was taking steps that would place his stamp on the presidency in a manner more significant than image. In not style, but substance. Substance, moreover, on the grand scale. In a program whose goal, the institutionalization of compassion in government policy, was, in fact, of a scope so vast that were it to be realized, it would transform a nation. He had known back in Washington, of course, that new substance was a necessity, that while I have to carry out the Kennedy legacy, at the same time I've got to put my own stamp on this administration in order to run for office. The Christmas interlude on the ranch was the time to make the necessary preparations, for almost immediately after his return from Texas, at 12:30 p.m. on January 8, 1964, he would deliver the State of the Union address to Congress. If he wanted to announce a new policy, that speech was the place to do it. The origin of the annual address was the constitutional provision that the president shall from time to time give to the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. And the speech had evolved over the life of the Republic into the vehicle in which a president, at the beginning of each congressional session, announced policy, revealed programs, and set the agenda which his administration would be pursuing. It was largely because of Woodrow Wilson's determination to take a more forceful role in proposing and pushing for the passage of legislation that he had in 1913 revived the original practice, followed by George Washington and John Adams, but abandoned by Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson said he felt the practice was too similar to the address a British monarch makes to Parliament and was therefore too regal for a democracy, of delivering the address in person instead of sending it to the Hill in writing. Franklin Roosevelt had announced many of his New Deal programs, Harry Truman all of his Fair Deal, in their State of the Union speeches. Because the speech was televised, furthermore, it was an opportunity for a president to talk beyond Congress to the people, to address the nation as a whole. Some of the agenda Lyndon Johnson would lay out on January 8th would still have to be Kennedy's. The tax cut and civil rights bills, still not passed by Congress, would have to be the first priorities. Continuity would have to remain a theme in the speech, but he knew there would have to be something more, something new. It was time to make the presidency his presidency. Ironically, the program with which he did it had had its beginning under Kennedy. In 1962, Michael Harrington's book The Other America, together with a lengthy review of the book by literary critic Dwight MacDonald in The New Yorker, had aroused liberals and intellectuals to the dilemma of one-fifth of America's population, the 30 million people who, in the midst of a wealthy and prosperous nation, were living in poverty that seemed intractable. Studies by sociologists were finding not only that the number of the poor was not falling, but that it was rising and was going to continue to do so. There will be considerably more poor, even with a more affluent America, because they are not part of the economic structure, one study concluded. Future economic growth alone will provide relatively few escapes from poverty, concurred a report by Walter Heller's Council of Economic Advisers. Existing government programs did not address that dilemma. Social Security does not cover them. Minimum wage laws specifically exempt them. Government welfare unwittingly contributes to broken homes and illegitimacy. School lunch programs have not nourished the communities that could not afford to transport the surplus foods or the children who could not make even the token payments. Then, in early 1963, articles by Homer Biggert in the New York Times on the plight of coal miners in Appalachia stirred President Kennedy, reminding him of the conditions he had witnessed when he had campaigned in the region in 1960. Anti-poverty, as an historian wrote, was in the air in Washington. When, in the spring of 1963, Heller asked the president for permission to conduct a quiet investigation into the problem of long-term, hardcore poverty in America, with a view to developing a program to deal with it, Kennedy gave him the go-ahead, and early that fall a task force of cabinet officers was organized, at first with Heller as chairman, for a rather vague purpose. As Heller's chief aide in the group, William N. Capron, was to put it, to come up with suggestions for items that might be included in proposals for legislation that would be introduced in Congress in 1964. But it wasn't much of a beginning. Operating without clear direction from the president, the group produced results that were, in Capron's words, perhaps predictably disastrous. A lot of warmed-over revisions of proposals that had been around a long time, coming up out of the bureaucracy, programs that had already been rejected by Congress, little bits and pieces that didn't really hang together. Although in October Sorensen took over the chairmanship of the group, the agencies weren't paying a lot of attention because they weren't sure that the president really wanted it. At a White House meeting in mid-October, Sorensen told the task force to, in effect, go back and do some more homework. Heller was to recall him saying, "Keep at it. It's the kind of an issue we should sign on to, and it's a terribly important thing." Then on November 13th, during the first planning session for the 1964 presidential campaign, the meeting to which Johnson wasn't invited, Census Bureau Director Richard Scammon, on whom Kennedy was relying to analyze the demographics of the 1964 election, told the president that, "You can't get a single vote more by doing anything for poor people. Those who vote are already for you," and advised him to concentrate instead on issues that would be popular in the rapidly expanding, vote-rich, middle-class suburbs. I then heard from Ted Sorensen some rather disquieting comment about, "We may have to put more emphasis on the suburbs," Heller says. Going directly to Kennedy, he asked the president to tell him his current feelings. Heller left a number of versions of that meeting. According to one set of notes he made, Kennedy's response was, "I am still very much in favor of doing something on the poverty theme to make sure we can get a good program. But I also think it's important to make clear that we're doing something for the middle-income man in the suburbs, etc. But the two are not at all inconsistent with each, so go right ahead with your work on it." According to another version Heller left, the president told him to come back to me in a couple of weeks. This is what Kennedy told me on November 19th. With little sense of urgency emanating from the Oval Office, when Heller's aides tried to discuss specific legislative proposals with cabinet officials, they sometimes had trouble even getting appointments. Gordon's schedule was too jammed up or something, Capron recalls of one attempt. While it was still possible that some bills might be drawn up for 1964, it was generally thought that they wouldn't be pressed very hard until after the 1964 presidential campaign. In addition, that beginning received scant notice from the press. Congress had never held a single full-scale debate on the subject. Public awareness of poverty, as a governmental or political issue, was, in Evans and Novak's term, virtually non-existent. An anti-poverty program would not, unlike the tax cut or civil rights, be identified with Kennedy, would not, in the public mind, be a Kennedy program that Johnson was continuing. It was an issue that he could make his own. And he made it his own. When Heller had first mentioned it to the new president, the response had a different tone from the one he had received from President Kennedy. The mention and the response had occurred during Heller's first meeting with Johnson in the Executive Office Building on the evening of November 23rd, as the Economist was briefing the new president about economic issues that had been under discussion in the Kennedy administration. When he told Johnson about the poverty issue, his reaction immediately was, "That's my kind of program. I'll find money for it one way or another. If I have to, I'll take money away from things to get money for people." That was the meeting at which, as Heller was leaving, Johnson stopped him, shut the door, and assured him that he was not a conservative, but a Roosevelt New Dealer, and "I should be sure to tell my friends that." The conversation at the door, Heller was to say, was a little calculated, a play for support. There he was, Lyndon Johnson, the politician. There was, Heller felt, no calculation in Lyndon Johnson's response on poverty. That was so spontaneous and so immediate, an instinctive and intuitive and uncalculated response. Heller then asked him point blank how fast he wanted to move on anti-poverty. Johnson responded in Heller's words that "we should push ahead full tilt." Arriving at the ranch on December 29th, Heller and Kermit Gordon found that Johnson had been doing that on his own. The emphasis on reducing the budget to satisfy Harry Byrd had led the two economists to concentrate on finding funds for the anti-poverty program within existing federal programs, on spending a portion of funds already earmarked for manpower training or youth employment, for example, on programs specifically directed at people below the federally defined poverty line. A total of $500 million had, in fact, been thus identified in a number of programs, and they had been lumped together and labeled an anti-poverty program. The thinking in Washington was to use those funds on modest pilot projects, demonstration programs, some of them defined only vaguely, to test their workability. "We started out with the notion that we were not talking about big new budget resources, and that was a constraint," Capron says. "That's why we talked about a targeted demonstration program. We used the argument that we were all terribly ignorant about poverty and programmatic ways to do something about it, and that we had to learn a lot more. We were not talking about a massive program at all." And even about these modest programs, there was mostly confusion and competition, Washington turf wars. A December 20th meeting of cabinet officers and lower-level officials disintegrated into what participants call a nasty jurisdictional dispute, with angry arguments among the cabinet officers over who would control the various projects, with Sorensen at the head of the table too morose to take charge. It was, Capron says, clear there wasn't going to be a big new program of any kind. Immediately upon Heller and Gordon's arrival at the ranch, however, this clarity vanished. The two economists found that Johnson had found new money for the program, that he had meant what he said when he blurted out, "I'll take money away from things to get money for people." The overall budget was, of course, coming down. Johnson didn't want it to start going back up. McNamara's Defense Department economies had started to add up, however. And out of these savings, they found, Johnson had reserved money for the anti-poverty program, and the amount he had thus reserved was $500 million, which, added to the $500 million from existing programs, meant there would be twice as much, $1 billion for anti-poverty, as they had been thinking about. And inadequate though the total might still be, 1% of a nation's spending specifically directed at the 20% of its people who most needed help, a $1 billion figure had a symbolic, significant ring to it. Gordon and Heller had been thinking of a pilot venture to be carried out in a limited number of demonstration projects, Johnson wrote in his memoirs. But I urged them to broaden their scope. The program had to be big and bold and hit the nation with real impact. As he had earlier explained the congressional realities of the tax cut to Heller and Gordon, now he laid out for them a basic congressional reality that would confront an anti-poverty program. Why a limited number of smaller projects would never pass. Why the program would have to be big and bold if it was to have a chance of enactment. A small number of projects, he explained, meant that only a small number of congressional districts would receive the new federal funds, and the number of congressmen with a vested interest in supporting the program would therefore be small. I was certain that we could not start small and propel a program through Congress, he was to say. He wanted them to find new programs in which to spend it. There was a new urgency. He kept asking, "How are you going to spend all this money?" Heller recalls. He was extremely demanding. Time and time again he said, "Look, I've earmarked $500 million to get this program started, but I'll withdraw that unless you fellows come through with something that's workable." There was a new demand for specifics. He wanted something concrete, Heller was to recall. He made it very clear that they, the programs, had to have some hard bedrock content, and he kept referring time and again to his NYA, National Youth Administration, experience. He liked the idea of learning while doing, learning through doing, but he didn't want to go just back, but forward. "The challenge I presented to my advisors was the development of a new concept," he was to write. "I didn't want to paste together a lot of existing approaches. I wanted original, inspiring ideas." Part of the explanation for Lyndon Johnson's enthusiasm for the anti-poverty program was, as was always the case with Lyndon Johnson, political. In addition, all his efforts on behalf of the tax cut and civil rights bills had not come close to erasing liberal suspicions about him. On the day Johnson flew back to Washington from Texas, the liberal columnist William V. Shannon would tell his readers that the credit for anything the new president might have accomplished belonged not to him but to John F. Kennedy. That now the honeymoon was over and it was time for him to produce on his own, and that, judging from his record, it was doubtful that he could. "All of us have been grateful to our new president," Shannon wrote in a tone that suggested that he himself had not been overwhelmed by that emotion, "for the magisterial way in which he took hold of his responsibilities. His energy, self-confidence, and natural energy have been therapeutic in a disheartening and troubled time. His conduct in the past several weeks, which impressed everyone, is already part of the history of the Kennedy period. It was a fitting epilogue to the Kennedy story." Now, Shannon said, the time had come to view the Johnson administration on its own. "It is time to examine President Johnson in the cold winter light of the problems and opportunities which confront him." The view was not reassuring. History suggests that the martyrdom of a great man does not necessarily have positive political consequences. Lincoln's, for example, led only to the failures of Reconstruction. What was the political sequel to Woodrow Wilson's personal sacrifice when he broke his health in a stumping tour on behalf of the League of Nations? The isolation and corruption of the Harding administration. As for Johnson, Shannon wrote, he is politically weak in the Northeast and in the big cities generally, in the liberal urban areas. And he wrote there was good reason for that weakness. "We have already witnessed the failures that occurred last month." Shannon was classifying as failures the new president's inability to get the tax and civil rights bills through Congress before the end of the year. And he said those failures might be symptomatic of disturbing qualities in Johnson. "There are genuine ambiguities in his legislative record, and Moreover, as a legislator, he overemphasized his talent for adjustment and compromise at the expense of commitment. We have to acknowledge that there are valid grounds for apprehension regarding Mr. Johnson or any other public man whose emphasis is almost wholly on means rather than ends. The broker concept is inadequate for the far more demanding office of the presidency. What are a man's values, his moral ends, his vision of justice? These are the important questions. Shannon's was far from the only liberal voice still asking such questions. A campaign against poverty would strengthen Johnson in the liberal urban areas in which he was weakest. And there was a political reason for launching the campaign quickly, an election that was now just 10 months away. But part of the explanation was, as always with Johnson, something more, something that had less to do with strategy than with memories. The ranch, with the pathetic frame house and the road across the river, was, after all, an appropriate setting for him to be thinking about poverty. And allusions in his conversation, both in person and over the telephone, sentences, phrases, reminiscences, allusions that started to be heard as he chatted on the plane ride down to Texas and that continued to sprinkle his speech during the 2 weeks on the ranch, show how fresh his youth was in his mind during that time. Talking to reporters on the plane about the federal budget, he had suddenly stopped and begun talking about himself. "I've always been an early riser," he said. "My daddy used to come to my bedroom at 4:30 in the morning when I was working on the highway gang, right out of high school, and he'd twist my big toe real hard so it hurt, and he'd say, 'Get up, Lyndon, every other boy in town's got a half hour's head start on you.'" Making an early morning call to an old hill country ally, E. Babe Smith of Marble Falls, he said he hoped he hadn't woken him up, and then said he was sure he hadn't because Smith had been a poor boy too, and therefore must have been getting up early all his life, as he himself did. "That's the only way we can keep up," he said. "Otherwise they're too far ahead of us." Other old acquaintances recall similar early morning calls from the Johnson Ranch that vacation. "We always get up early, don't we?" he told Fredericksburg attorney Arthur Stelling. "We can't make it unless we do." And at the age of 9 and 10, he had worked beside his cousin Ava, hauling the heavy bags of cotton, their backs stooped over in the burning sun. Ava, to whom he had whispered as they worked, "Boy, there's got to be a better way to make a living than this. There's got to be a better way." Asked by the author, 12 years after that Christmas trip, what she and Lyndon had talked about that Christmas, Ava said she didn't remember, except that they had reminisced about their youth and about the cotton picking. Whenever she and Lyndon reminisced, that subject came up, she said. "We always talked about the cotton. We just had hated that so much." Hate is, in fact, a word that occurs frequently in descriptions of Lyndon Johnson's feelings about poverty. He hated poverty and illiteracy, Dr. Hurst would say. He hated it when a person who wanted to work could not get a job. Accompanying Johnson on a vice presidential trip to Iran, Hurst had seen his reaction when someone in the party said that a group of Iranian children they passed had rags for clothing. "They did not," Johnson said. "Don't say that. I know rags when I see them. They had patched clothes. That is a lot different than rags." Hurst says that, "I noted as the years passed that he reacted in the same way whenever he heard the word rags. I realized that to him rags were the ultimate symbol of the poverty he detested." There had, after all, been patches on clothing worn by his brother and youngest sister, who had still been small when Sam Johnson went broke on the ranch, and that clothing certainly hadn't been rags. From the moment Heller and Gordon arrived at the ranch that Christmas, Johnson hounded them to get him an anti-poverty package with hard, concrete, specific programs that would produce results. The two economists were quartered in the green frame guest house, and in the late evenings, when they, and perhaps Moyers and Valenti, were sitting around a little kitchen table littered with papers and coffee cups, its ashtray overflowing with cigarette butts, the president would suddenly appear in the doorway. He found the scene amusing, he was to recall. "Just a few feet from the window, several of my white-faced Herefords were grazing placidly and a little noisily. It was an incongruous setting for Gordon and Heller. Those two urbane scholars." Gordon was wearing one of his host's khaki western shirts, far too large for him, with what we Texans called city-bought trousers and low city shoes. Sitting down at the table, Johnson bantered with him about his half-hearted attempt to blend in with his surroundings. Johnson's mind was on the anti-poverty legislative program, however. When he was with the men working on it, all subjects, even their attire, were seen in their relation to that. When Gordon replied to the joking about his clothes by saying he was trying to blend urban and cattle country, it struck me that the poverty program itself was a blend of the same, of the needs and desperate desires of the poor in the city ghettos and the poor in obscure rural hollows, and that the new program must therefore include provisions not only for the urban slums on which attention was focused, but also for rural areas, scattered, obscure, in which needs were just as desperate. Eager for new ideas, he even accepted one that had emerged from the President's Committee on Juvenile Delinquency and Youth Crime, chaired by a long-time Robert Kennedy friend, David Hackett. While Johnson was talking about concrete bulldozer projects, Hackett's committee had been urging him to make a concept called Community Action, a vague proposal to involve the residents of impoverished neighborhoods in programs that affected them, a key part of the program. Opposed to the idea at first as being too vague, not something that would give people jobs or children an education, Johnson changed his mind, according to Busby, partly because it had emerged from a Kennedy committee, and opposing it would therefore conflict with the continuity theme. People would have said, oh, he's not really sincere. Johnson's own explanation was that while I realized that the community action concept might shake up many existing institutions, I decided that some shaking up might be needed to get a bold new program moving. While few specifics of the anti-poverty program had been decided upon when, on January 3rd, the two economists flew back to Washington from the ranch, by the time they left, the atmosphere surrounding the program bore little resemblance to the atmosphere that had existed before November 22nd. There was no more talk about coming back in a couple of weeks. Instead, there were orders to have the Budget Bureau and the other government agencies involved draw up detailed recommendations and to draw them up fast. By Monday, January 6th, they were ready, and the two economists sent them to cabinet members with a covering memo. Your preliminary reactions are required before the close of business Thursday, January 9th, the memo said. Other deadlines were set, also tight deadlines. And by the end of the vacation, the program had a name. The 1964 State of the Union message, first draft, was completed in the little house on the Lewis Ranch on December 30th, and a secretary was driven up to decipher and transcribe Ted Sorensen's tiny handwriting, and the draft's first page contained the words, "Let this session of Congress be known as the session which declared all-out war on human poverty and misery and unemployment in these United States." And the fifth page contained the words, "This administration hereby declares unconditional war on poverty in America." While during the next week the message would go through many drafts, those sentences were to remain, essentially unchanged, in all of them. The provenance of the phrase, war on poverty, is difficult to determine. When the author of this book asked Sorensen about it, Sorensen said that, "It doesn't sound like something President Kennedy would have been comfortable saying or that I would have been comfortable writing." In fact, however, President Kennedy had said it in a little-noticed campaign speech in 1960, which, it appears, Sorensen wrote. Whether the phrase sprang from Sorensen's pen as he scribbled away in the guest house, or whether it was suggested to him by Lyndon Johnson in their early discussions about the speech, it caught Johnson's fancy, because it caught Johnson's feelings. Why wouldn't it? Lyndon Johnson knew what to do with enemies. And if to destroy them war was necessary, war it would be. There would later, not at the time, be criticism of the phrases and sentences in which the war was declared for their overblown hyperbolic quality, their gaudy rhetoric. But, says Elizabeth Wickenden, the whole idea of declaring a big war on poverty and ending it for all time, all the rhetoric of it, appealed to him very much. By the time Johnson flew back to Washington, the speech had been finished in essentially its final form, and it laid out an anti-poverty program with only a few details filled in, but designed to right on a vast scale, vast wrongs. The moral arc of the universe bends slowly, but it bends towards justice. Lyndon Johnson was trying to bend it faster. The State of the Union came 3 days after he flew back from the ranch. In the message, he gave Congress, as the mandate required, information, a startling announcement about the budget for the next fiscal year. "Under the budget that I shall shortly submit," he said, "there would be an actual reduction in federal expenditures and federal employment." A reduction in the number of federal employees, he said, would be a feat accomplished only once before in the last 10 years. And he said the reduction would be substantial. "As for the size of the overall budget, it will call for total expenditures of $97,900 million. Not only had he cut the budget below $100 billion, he had cut it so far below that magic figure that Harry Byrd wouldn't feel it had been brought in below only through accounting gimmicks. It was, in fact, lower, $500 million lower than the previous year's budget of $98.4 billion. That announcement allowed him to segue into the need for a tax cut. A lower budget, he said, was an argument for lower taxes. Unemployment was still unacceptably high. "I would remind you that, despite America's prosperity, 4 million workers are still idle today. By creating an incentive for business investment, a reduction in the corporate tax rate would create jobs. That tax bill has been thoroughly discussed for a year," he said. "Now we need action. The new budget clearly allows for it. Our taxpayers surely deserve it. Our economy strongly demands it. And the most damaging and devastating thing you can do to any businessman in America is to keep him in doubt and to keep him guessing on what our tax policy is." The tax cut, of course, was his predecessor's tax cut, and while President Kennedy's name was invoked only 3 times during the 43-minute speech, the invocations were couched in terms, Sorensen's terms, so stirring: "Let us carry forward the plans and programs of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, not because of our sorrow or sympathy, but because they are right," that the theme of continuity could still be heard in the address. And then, about 13 minutes into the speech, Lyndon Johnson introduced a new theme. "Unfortunately," he said, "many Americans live on the outskirts of hope, some because of their poverty and some because of their color, and all too many because of both. Our task is to help replace their despair with opportunity." His voice as he spoke those sentences was low, almost soft, reasonable in tone. But the next sentence rang out with its Texas twang across the big chamber. "This administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America." Retaining the words in Sorensen's draft, Johnson had added 4 words to them, Lyndon Johnson words: "today, here, and now." So hard did he pound them in as they rang out across the rows of upturned faces before him that they might have been underlined in the air. "It will not be a short or easy struggle," Lyndon Johnson said. "No single weapon or strategy will suffice, but we shall not rest until that war is won. The richest nation on earth can afford to win it. We cannot afford to lose it." Although a few lines of attack were mentioned, a special effort, an effort begun under President Kennedy, in the chronically distressed areas of Appalachia, enactment of new youth employment legislation reminiscent of the NYA, to put jobless, aimless, hopeless youngsters to work on useful projects, the speech was short on specific strategies for the war's prosecution. While the community action concept was endorsed, the endorsement came in terms too vague for its implications to be immediately apparent. "Poverty is a national problem requiring improved national organization and support. But this attack, to be effective, must also be organized at the state and local level and must be supported and directed by state and local efforts," was what Johnson said on that subject. The war's causes, the reasons it was necessary, were made clear, however, as were in general terms the weapons that would be deployed and the enemies at which he was aiming. "To help that 1/5 of all American families with incomes too small to even meet their basic needs," he said, "our chief weapons will be better schools, and better health and better homes, and better training, and better job opportunities to help more Americans, especially young Americans, escape from squalor and misery and unemployment rolls." squalor, misery, unemployment. As Lyndon Johnson named those targets, his eyes, behind the thick glasses, narrowed, and his lips, set already in that grim, tough line, tightened and twisted into an expression close to a snarl. And he continued with words that, while none of them applied specifically to the circumstances of his own life, might nevertheless have had a special resonance for someone who had grown up in poverty and who knew it was only because he hadn't been given a fair chance. "Very often a lack of jobs and money is not the cause of poverty, but the symptom," he said. "The cause may lie deeper. In our failure to give our fellow citizens a fair chance to develop their own capacities, in a lack of education and training, in a lack of medical care and housing, in a lack of decent communities in which to live and bring up their children." He paused. "But whatever the cause, our joint federal-local effort must pursue poverty, pursue it wherever it exists, in city slums and small towns, in sharecropper shacks or in migrant worker camps, on Indian reservations, among whites as well as Negroes, among the young as well as the aged, in the boom towns and in the depressed areas." And the aim of the war was made clear, too, and as he enunciated it, it was titanic, nothing less than the unconditional transformation of a nation to eradicate a great injustice. "Our aim is not only to relieve the symptoms of poverty, but to cure it, and above all, to prevent it," he said. "Improved medical care was tied in with the war," he said. "We must provide hospital insurance for our older citizens, financed by every worker and his employer under Social Security, to protect him in his old age in a dignified manner against the devastating hardship of prolonged or repeated illness." Civil rights was tied in with it. While he had been in Texas, reporters in Washington, discussing with Mansfield, Dirksen, and other Senate leaders the prospects for the civil rights bill, had concluded that its passage in its present form was all but impossible. The heroism on the streets of the South hadn't changed things. The tumultuous events of recent months have not altered the nose count in the Senate on civil rights, Marquis Childs wrote. At most, 43 or 44 of the 67 Democrats will vote to shut off a filibuster. That is grim arithmetic. It means that no fewer than 25 Republicans must vote for cloture. Those 25 will be hard to come by. And because of that arithmetic, what the New York Times called persistent reports had begun circulating in Washington that in order to secure more votes, Johnson might permit the bill's public accommodations section to be eliminated or watered down. The State of the Union address lay that speculation to rest. "Let me make one principle of this administration abundantly clear," Johnson said. "All of these increased opportunities, in employment, in education, in housing, and in every field, must be open to Americans of every color. As far as the writ of federal law will run, we must abolish not some, but all racial discrimination. For this is not merely an economic issue, or a social, political, or international issue. It is a moral issue, and it must be met by the passage this session of the bill now pending in the House. All members of the public should have equal access to facilities open to the public. All members of the public should be equally eligible for federal benefits that are financed by the public. All members of the public should have an equal chance to vote for public officials and to send their children to good public schools and to contribute their talents to the public good." "Today," Lyndon Johnson said, "Americans of all races stand side by side in Berlin and in Vietnam. They died side by side in Korea. Surely they can work and eat and travel side by side in their own country." In sharp contrast to John Kennedy's State of the Union addresses, only about a quarter of Johnson's speech was devoted to foreign policy, and it was the last quarter. None of that portion was newsworthy or even particularly significant, although its references to Khrushchev's threat to bury the United States — "We intend to bury no one, and we do not intend to be buried," Johnson said, received, predictably, the loudest applause of any line he delivered. Vietnam was mentioned in this portion of the speech only once, when Johnson said America must be better prepared than ever before to defend the cause of freedom, whether it is threatened by outright aggression or by the infiltration practiced by those in Hanoi and Havana, who ship arms and men across international borders to foment insurrection. In fact, the only other mention of Vietnam in the entire speech was the statement that Americans of all races stand side by side there. Politically, the speech was a triumph. Clustering around Republicans as they left the chamber, reporters found the expected hostile reactions muted, pro forma, a little lame. "He's proposing a cut-rate utopia," was the best one GOP representative could come up with. The furthest Dirksen would go was to say that the message seemed almost like a blueprint for the kind of paradise devoutly to be wished by everyone. But how do you do all these things, and with less money? And the press understood why. The House Republican whip, Leslie C. Ahrens of Illinois, said that Johnson promises something for everyone. But if that was indeed what he had done, everyone, voters, might not be disposed to object. Saying that Republicans found the speech hard to get at, the Washington Post quoted a Democrat in explanation. "It's the Sermon on the Mount. How can anyone attack it?" The Post said that both his fellow Democrats and Republicans knew they had heard a consummate political artist at work, and that he had created a tour de force that was hard to criticize. "Johnson manages to touch all the bases in a show of politics and statesmanship," a Post headline said. The analysis underneath it concluding that there was something for everybody. Economy for the conservatives, an anti-poverty program for the depressed one-fifth of our partially affluent society, a joyous tax cut that will give the economy a juicy shot by summer and fall. In short, Mr. Johnson had his arm around the shoulder of so much of the Congress and so many of the voters yesterday that he didn't leave the Republicans much of a spot to take hold. No wonder senators and House members had sat like pupils being given the lesson for tomorrow, the Post said. No wonder they hung on to his every whisper and applauded so often. He took the high road of statesmanship, and they knew he was making hay politically. Remarkable was an adjective used in editorials and in columns like Arthur Crock's, remarkable for its bold sweep and the bold idealism of his programs, for its eloquence in composition and the masterly manner of its delivery. "President Johnson's first State of the Union message today was a classic political document," the Times said. And the triumph was also on a level above the political. Masterful as it was politically, Times said, it was much more as well. An editorial that may have proved particularly gratifying to Johnson, coming as it did in the New York Post, codifier of liberal opinion, said that the speech had reinforced the image of a man who has risen resolutely to the tragic occasion under which he assumed office. It praised his budget. "The arithmetic of his argument may be subject to complicated dispute," its editorial said, "but even the most ritualistic budget balancers cannot fail to be impressed by the boldness with which he and Defense Secretary McNamara have attacked the problems of waste in the military establishment. Military budgets have long been treated as politically untouchable. President Johnson has served notice that a day of real reckoning for the Pentagon has arrived." And then it added that, "If excessive sums allocated for overkill, obsolescence, and other forms of military extravagance can be applied to positive social outcomes, the country can only be fundamentally stronger. And that seems to be Mr. Johnson's grand design." It was an address from which Americans could derive pride and inspiration, the Post said. The chorus of praise focused at first not on the anti-poverty program, but on the budget reduction. This was the stunner, in Newsweek's account, a near miraculous achievement in the Washington Post's. The key word in headlines across the country was not poverty, but economy. "Johnson vows economy," was the Chicago Tribune's banner. "President, economy vow," the New York Herald Tribune's. The announcement that the budget was lower than Kennedy's was the new president's most dramatic passage, the New York Daily News said. "No one had expected that," the Times chimed in. "The fact that it is lower is regarded as a considerable political coup for Mr. Johnson." The scope of the anti-poverty proposal took a few weeks to sink in part because there had been little preparation for it. At least one public-spirited lobbyist in Washington who had been working long and hard to stir up a fight against poverty in the United States was caught by surprise to learn that President Johnson was declaring unconditional war on the ancient enemy, the Washington reporter Douglas Cater wrote in the Reporter magazine in February. Despite his own longtime core interest in the subject, Cater wrote, he himself had heard none of the usual bureaucratic rumblings to indicate such a major governmental initiative in the making. By the end of those few weeks, however, the scope, the revolutionary ambition of the proposal had begun to be understood. The concerted effort at federal, state, and local levels, for which President Johnson is calling, could inject government into social planning on a scale never before attempted, Cater wrote. Cater knew there was need for such an effort. There is every reason why government cannot ignore the people who, in Johnson's phrase, are living on the outskirts of hope. Yet, he noted, poverty has so far lacked a power base in Washington capable of sustaining its claims. Will Johnson show the perseverance to keep his program on target? Cater asked. Though his activities to date are largely on the propaganda side, there are some promising signs. And, despite the efforts of Kennedy adherents who hurried to explain to columnists and reporters that the poverty program was really Kennedy's program, the program was accepted as Johnson's. In launching a campaign against poverty, President Johnson is carrying on what President Kennedy was intending to do, Walter Lippmann wrote. I'm told that the basic policy was Kennedy's and that its translation into a program is Johnson's. But Lippmann made clear that quibble had little significance to him. The new president knows about the hidden and forgotten American poor. In style and in substance, the president's message is an intimate and personal display of the political gifts for which Lyndon Johnson is celebrated. He shows himself to be a passionate seeker with an uncanny gift for finding, beneath public issues, common ground on which men could stand. The new program, he announced, combined with the demeanor with which he announced it, had achieved another of his purposes. Once before, during the nightmare that was November, Lyndon B. Johnson stood at the speaker's rostrum and addressed himself to Congress. But while the voice was the prairie drawl of President Johnson, the words echoed the program of the fallen President Kennedy. There was no mistaking either voice or words last week, Newsweek said. This was President Johnson speaking, very much his own man in his first State of the Union message, forcefully determined upon a program of his own making. His own administration had clearly begun. The transition between the 35th and 36th presidencies of the United States, the period that had begun at the moment on November 22, 1963, when Ken O'Donnell had said of the 35th president, "He's gone," had been brought to an end with Lyndon Johnson's speech on January 8, 1964. It had lasted 47 days, just short of 7 weeks. Now it was over. I've got to put my own stamp on this administration, Johnson had known. In his State of the Union message, he had done just that, had made the presidency his own, put a stamp, a brand on it. He had done it with an announcement of a program with goals so new and ambitious that it was necessary to go back to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal to find, perhaps not an equal, but at least a comparison. The ranch on which, during that Christmas vacation, he had created the program's outline was just down the road from the Junction School, where, as a small boy, he had scrawled his name across two blackboards in letters so large that schoolmates, become old men, still remembered the huge Lyndon B. on one blackboard and Johnson on the other. The program he had announced in the State of the Union was of dimensions so sweeping that with it he was trying to write his name across the whole long slate of American history. Chapter 22 Old Harry 2 Among the hundreds of representatives and senators crowded into the long curved rows of seats as Lyndon Johnson spoke of the State of the Union, was the one whose reaction was most crucial. From her front row seat in the gallery above, Lady Bird Johnson was searching for Harry Bird every time the word budget was mentioned. The new president's efforts to bring old Harry over, to get him, as he had sometimes gotten him in the past, had been resumed before the speech, on the day following Johnson's return from Texas. The Finance Committee chairman had made his cooperation on the tax cut bill, contingent on Johnson's promise not only to bring the budget in under $100 billion without gimmicks, but to show him and John Williams, finance's ranking Republican, written documentation of that. Despite the acceleration in his committee's processing of amendments, enough of them were being held in reserve to ensure that the finance hearings could take whatever length of time the chairman desired. Knowing that the promise would have to be redeemed, Johnson's response when, on January 6th, Kermit Gordon finally reported that the budget was locked up, was to ask him, "When am I going to get the galley proofs of the final printed version and the tally sheets, the unofficial ledgers used by the Budget Bureau for its calculations?" "I'm going to have to show them to Harry Byrd sometime."